Democracy, a strong democracy requires a strong citizenry, which is evident tonight by all of you being here. And we also know that a strong democracy requires responsible and responsive public officials. And this is a process tonight, an opportunity for you to learn more about the candidates and to engage them on issues that matter. This is a forum, not a debate, and so the following is the agenda we'll cover tonight. We'll begin with each of the candidates speaking for 2 minutes, and Robin will let people know when their time is up. And then we'll have 25 minutes or so of pre-planned questions that the candidates have not seen, and they will each speak and an opening statement for 2 minutes, and then the 25 minutes of pre-planned questions, followed by hopefully a half an hour of questions from the audience. I'll go over the instructions again when we get to that part of the meeting, but in short, we'll invite people to ask a brief question to which the candidates will have 2 minutes to respond. And we will abide by the behavior and rules for the Cleveland Heights Dems that Linda just went over. There's a gavel here if I need it. There's seats up front, folks, if you are looking for a chair. And so then we'll have 2 minutes of closing remarks, comments by each of the candidates. And by a flip of a coin, we will be starting with Mr. Ahn in the opening statement, which means that in the closing statement, Mr. O'Malley will go first. Yes, this session is being recorded. It's not being live streamed, but it is being recorded, so you know that. And so without further ado, we will begin with the first 2 minutes of opening statements.
Thank you, Dr. Chup. Thank you to all the clubs who helped put on this event, and thank you to all of you for being here tonight. My name is Matthew Ahn. I am a law professor, a former resident of Cleveland Heights, and a former public defender. And I am running for Cuyahoga County Prosecutor because I believe that we can create justice for all. Justice is educational security, which I helped low-income and first-generation students pursue while teaching at Tri-C. Justice is the opportunity to succeed, which I fought for as a special education attorney, representing parents of children being denied accommodations. And justice is rehabilitation and success upon reentry, which I helped my clients achieve as a public defender. The fundamental truth is that we create justice for all when we work to prevent crime, not just to respond to it. But that's not what's happening in the prosecutor's office right now. We have an elected official who refuses to understand the research behind addressing and preventing crime. An elected official who implements practices that worsen racial disparities and make us all less safe. An elected official that maintains policies that are out of step and out of line with Democratic Party principles. Somebody who is willing to blame anybody but themselves for the rise in crime that has happened under their watch. Folks, this is not the behavior of a strong leader. It is instead a crisis of leadership at the top of the prosecutor's office. As your prosecutor, I will target the crimes that harm our community, build an office in the people's interest, work to break the cycle of trauma, and support rehabilitation through services. That is justice for all, and it's why I'm running to be your next Cuyahoga County prosecutor. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's an honor to be here. For the past 7 years, I've had the honor of being your Cuyahoga County prosecutor. And I've got to be honest, it's tough to sit here and listen to an individual spew out things that are so negative without having an ounce of knowledge of the criminal justice system within our county. None. Not one case has he handled. Not one victim has he sat down with. Not one neighborhood meeting has he gone to. Not any police agency has he actually sat down with and tried to say, how do we prevent what's going on here and who's starting the problems within your community? It's great, you know, my job isn't about running from subway stop to subway stop. It comes from being a practicing attorney for 32 years who's done criminal defense work, who's been as Cleveland City Councilman and represented people on the ground floor, somebody who has sat with victims and held victims whose sons, husbands, wives have been murdered. None of this is easy. I can tell you this, I have the toughest position in elected politics in this county. I do, and my staff does, some of whom are here, try to help people and represent people and to seek justice, because in Matt's version of justice, you never hear the word justice correlated to a victim. I gotta be honest, I am not the public defender. That's a role that Matt has had in his brief legal career. I am somebody who represents the victims of crime, but that's not all we do. My office handles all the civil litigation for Cuyahoga County. We handle Children Family Services, where we have 2,300 kids who are in protective custody within our county. We do 2,000 tax foreclosure cases within our county, and it's not as simple as 12 discretionary bindovers. Thank you.
Okay, now we'll go to the pre-planned questions, and I will read the first question. The first question is about juvenile bindovers. A juvenile bindover, for those who don't know, is when a juvenile court transfers jurisdiction for a child to the adult court for criminal prosecution. The rate of juvenile bindovers varies across counties in Ohio, with some counties having a rate of 0% and others having a rate of 60%. Prosecutors have the discretion to determine the charges, and unlike a judge, their decisions are not subject to appellate court review. Cuyahoga County has a history of leading the state in juvenile bindovers in the state, even compared to other urban counties. First, Mr. O'Malley, what have you done to address this issue?
Certainly. You know, Matt has expressed a disagreement on discretionary bindovers, and when we've had talks on discretionary bindovers, it was clear to me that he wasn't even aware of what a discretionary bindover could be. This year, we have about 60 discretionary bindovers. Shockingly, about 7 or 8 of those have been bound over in previous layer, but let me tell you the sad statistics of Cuyahoga County. 23 of the bindovers this year are for ag murder, 10 are for attempted murder, 25 are for repeat ag robbers, the type of people who are damaging Cleveland Heights, Shaker Heights, Cleveland, South Euclid, and all the communities that are represented here. None of the decisions that are made at the juvenile bindover level are easy. We work and always work towards rehabilitation. It's why in my tenure, a juvenile intervention center was started in 2019 with the work of the United Pastors and Mission also and Cuyahoga County Council, where we now have a juvenile diversion center, intervention center, where 1/3 of our cases are diverted. Over 1,000 cases this year, including felonies 3s, 4s, and 5s, go through the diversionary track because of the work of myself and my office and the juvenile court staff. So while some may dwell on 12 discretionary bindovers or 15 discretionary bindovers, which are all tragic, but also include murders, I look at the work that we have accomplished as a whole, and it's sad when a judge has to make a decision on a discretionary bindover. But I'll never knock a judge for making the tough decisions that they do, because ultimately they're looking for towards whether the juvenile can be rehabilitated and trying to keep the community safe. Thank you.
So same issue, Mr. Ahn. What would you do differently to address this issue?
Thank you. Just a little bit of interesting trivia about the Cuyahoga County Juvenile Court. It was one of the first in the country. It was created with the understanding that we need to treat kids differently because kids are kids. right? And so what we should be doing in every case is looking to rehabilitation, because rehabilitation itself is crime prevention. And the story does not start when there is a potential for a child to be bound over. Very few children go from zero to some of the serious crimes that we see harming our community. Many of these children that we see committing very serious crimes have extensive juvenile records. And my question is, what has been happening in those cases in the past that we were not able to redirect those kids, that we have actually failed carry out the mission of the juvenile court? And so, you know, what we need to think about once we've gotten to the point where a child may have committed a fairly serious crime is what is best for them, right? In terms of making sure that we understand that they need to be able to reintegrate and live productive lives. There are good statistics that are vetted sort of across the nation that we have seen that children who are tried as adults and sent to adult court are more likely to commit crimes upon their release, right? What we're doing when binding children over is actually making us less safe in the long run. What we need to do is really focus on prevention while understanding that we need to hold children to account for the things that they've done. We can do both at once because there are plenty of tools within the juvenile court system, including a serious youthful offender sentence, for example, which I can get into, that exist for us to make sure we're not throwing children's lives away. Thank you.
Thank you for being very on time with the timekeeping. Got a good start here. The second question is, a few years ago, Ohio Supreme Court Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor made the following statement about bail reform. Quote, Ohio made great progress a year ago when courts were instructed to use the least restrictive bond conditions and the least amount of monetary bail to ensure a defendant's appearance. These latest changes expand both the fairness and the public safety in our system. Unquote. Question for Mr. Ahn first, and then Mr. O'Malley. Same question. Did the instruction from the Ohio Supreme Court regarding bail reform accomplish the goals of balancing fairness and public safety, or do we need to do more?
Thank you. There was a great report that the Marshall Project put out a few months ago about the state of cash bail in our county. The use of cash bail has decreased over time, and this is a good thing, because we're starting to think about pretrial detention as a matter of public safety rather than as a matter of whether somebody can afford to pay their way out. Cash bail does not have a strong connection to public safety. You have folks who might sit in jail because they cannot afford to post a bond of under $1,000. And yet at the same time, you might see somebody who commits a very serious crime who is still given a very high bond amount, but one that they can actually afford. We've seen both ends of this in this county over time, and neither of those makes sense. My proposal is to never ask for a cash bail amount. Either somebody is a threat to our community or a flight risk, they should be held in the jail, or they're not, and they should be released with whatever conditions ensure the safety of the community. It's really that simple. If we could do this, we would make our communities safer, we would decrease the jail population, we might even save some money on potential jail proposals for a replacement jail to be built. It's a no-brainer. Jurisdictions and states across the country are already doing this, and all that we can do this, we can improve our public safety, we can make sure that folks who don't need to be in that jail are not in the jail and having their lives destabilized by potentially losing their housing, losing custody of their family, losing their job. We want to make sure we're not doing that unnecessarily. And the way to do that is to move away entirely from cash bail and to really make this decision based on public safety. Thank you.
When I became Cuyahoga County Prosecutor in 2017, there were 2,200 people locked up in the county jail. Today, there is less than about 1,480. I enacted a policy immediately upon taking office. And just so everybody's aware how the bonds are set in Cuyahoga County, underneath the judges, there's something called a bond commissioner that is under, is an employee of the judges. They do background checks, do all the screening, and they make recommendations to the judge in the arraignment room exactly what they believe safety requires the bond to be. It's not a function of the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office. But what my function is I've enacted a policy that says we will never ask for a bond unless there is a danger to the victim, such as in a domestic violence situation, which we see frequently, where women continue to be abused. And so the bottom line is that my office has enacted a policy. When I took office, the judges set the bond. Now, along Matt's lines of a cash bail, just so everybody understands today, there's, like I said, there's roughly 1,450 people. I was told today that there is about 70 who are unable to pay their cash bond, and those generally are under $25,000. That is a tragedy, and it's wrong. And the bond commissioner's office, working with the court, have to find a way to do it. I don't know if Kareem Henton is here today, but there has been a fund created where Kareem Henton is out there posting cash bonds on behalf of people. But again, bonds are a function of the court. I don't believe people should be held because they can't make their bond. But again, it's a court function. Thank you.
Another important question is about the county prosecutor's role in cases of police misconduct. So I'll ask a specific question to each candidate. Mr. O'Malley, it has been said by your critics that your practice of farming out cases of police misconduct to prosecutors like State Attorney General Dave Yost, instead of handling themselves or delegating them to a private attorney, is troubling. Please explain your approach to handling police misconduct cases, and specifically your choice of handling the case versus selecting someone else to prosecute the case, and how you select such an alternative prosecutor.
Well, let me start off by saying that the question is an error. When I ran for this position 8 years ago, it was in the wake of the Tamir Wright homicide and tragedy, right? So it was agreed by all experts that the issue that brought that case to the forefront was the prosecutor's handling of a case that posed a conflict of interest because he was constantly working with the Cleveland Police Department, and that family felt like they did not get a fair shake because of the appearance of the conflict. I, throughout my campaign, had made a pledge that I would never handle a police homicide. And by the way, the Ohio Supreme Court did a report on this subject, and they agreed that all fatal homicide use of deadly force cases should be sent to the Attorney General, was their advice. I have done that and have done that on every police use of fatal force case. What I don't do, and whether the question was an error, is the issue regarding handing cases of police misconduct over. This community borders East Cleveland. In the last year, we have indicted 18 current and former East Cleveland police officers. And that's just one example, but it's the obvious one. So that case wasn't farmed out to anybody. And quite frankly, that case was investigated by the FBI. It was taken to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Ohio in Cleveland, who turned it down. I gladly took that case and proceeded to indict those 18 current and former officers, some of whom are now serving time in the Ohio State Penal System. So be clear, the only cases that I ever, consistent with my pledge from 8 years ago, turn over to a special prosecutor, unless there's a conflict within the office, are police use of deadly force cases. Thank you.
Same issue of police misconduct. Mr. Ahn, you say on your website that you want to create a dedicated public integrity unit to focus on misconduct by public servants and other powerful individuals, unquote. Assuming that you are referring, at least in part, to police misconduct, please explain what that quote means and what your approach would be as county prosecutor in cases of police misconduct.
Thank you. Creating a dedicated public integrity unit is one of the key parts of my platform. And there's a number of reasons why it's important to have a separate dedicated unit. One, of course, is to make sure that we are actually handling cases with folks who have the expertise to do so. The East Cleveland cases are coming out of this prosecutor's office's general felony unit. We want to make sure that we have folks that that have dedicated expertise in this area. The other issue here is one of a potential conflict of interest. Police often have to work very closely with police with prosecutors in order to do their jobs. And so when police misconduct comes up, we want to make sure that we don't have some kind of issue in terms of that relationship. And so having a dedicated unit that is further walled off is really important to make sure that we're not having those sorts of conflicts occur. Part of all of this is that we have seen a number of cases over the last years and decades in Cuyahoga County that have, you know, really, I think, shocked the community, and we haven't seen justice done. I was able to attend last Wednesday the 11th anniversary vigil for the 137 shots case. These are just examples of cases that I think the community has lost trust in the system to handle. Right? What we need in many ways is a fresh start. We need a particular sort of change to demonstrate, hey, we are going to take these cases seriously. We need somebody who is going to understand that these kinds of public corruption cases or these kinds of misconduct cases are important, and we need to have a strong leader who is willing to be accountable for those cases regardless of what the outcome is.
Okay. Our next question is directed at each candidate separately. Mr. Ahn, you're up again. Some progressive reform prosecutors around the country have stopped prosecuting or seeking only probation or diversion for what they deem low-level offenses, like burglary and thefts, claiming they want to focus on violent crimes. Do you subscribe to that philosophy? Also, what message does that send to both victims and perpetrators of such so-called low-level offenses?
That's a great question. And just to sort of clear up where I'm coming from, right? A lot of folks have tried to give me this label or that label as a candidate. I am here because I'm following the evidence, the data, and the research. I am trying to run a data-driven office. That's why I'm running. So with respect to pledging to seek only probation or diversion for a particular class of offense, I'm not sure that that makes a lot of sense. We need to take cases on a case-by-case basis. We need to see how things may have set up in that particular case. I would also object to the classification of burglary in particular as a case where some blanket policy like this might be appropriate. But these are questions that we want to ask. We oftentimes in the criminal justice system tend to over-prosecute against what I'll call crimes of desperation. We also tend to under-prosecute against what I will call crimes of power. Right? And that balance needs to be shifted a little bit. Now, the thing is, not every theft, not every burglary is necessarily going to be a crime of desperation. And so we want to still take a look at these cases, really understand what's happened with them, and act accordingly, right? Some of these cases may not need to be charged as a felony, but some of them probably do. And so we want to make sure that we're doing all of this work at the front end to save the taxpayers, to save our office, to save everybody who's involved in the system any additional time, effort, trouble on the back end. What this does is it makes the system a little bit more efficient. It helps cases move through the system more effectively. It will reduce our jail populations, and it will save the taxpayers of this county money. Thank you.
Mr. O'Malley, how would you rate your record over the past 7 years on handling low-level offenses? How do you balance the message that is sent to both victims and perpetrators of such so-called low-level offenses?
Thank you. Well, first, let me clear up a few misstatements by Matt that are important. You know, there was an article today on NPR2 where after I read it, I realized the old saying, you don't know what you don't know, because there were so many mistakes about the way our office operates. For instance, and we can get into the NPR article later on, but Matt just indicated that the East Cleveland cases were being handled by the General Felony Unit. The East Cleveland cases are not being handled by the General Felony Unit. They're being handled by a unit of three people that's called the Economic Crime Unit. And Matt wouldn't know that because he's never in the building. He doesn't know who anyone is, and he just got his law license last year, okay, in the state of Ohio. So he talks then about a case-by-case basis. Matt unknowingly pledged to people that he would never file a discretionary bindover. I don't believe he knew at the time that a discretionary bindover included things like murder. So on one hand, he's saying you have to look at cases on a case-by-case basis, but then he's rolling out a platform that is going to re-victimize every victim in this county. And I can highlight the most obvious case is that discretionary bindover out of Strongsville, where those two poor young adults got driven into a building at 100 miles an hour 2 days before that girl turned 18. That was a discretionary bindover. And the day that case was sentenced, I was sitting in Strongsville Dem Club with Matt, and we looked at the people, and I said, Matt's policy is that individual who killed those two young adults would serve 3 years. Does anybody think that blanket policy is fair? And I can tell you, everyone in that room said he's not looking at it on a case-by-case basis. He was trying to make himself more attractive to certain groups of people who are opposed to discretionary bindovers. I will look at cases on a case-by-case basis. And as far as low-level cases, I've started diversionary programs in the juvenile court that were never there that divert a third of our cases. Thank you.
As I said at the beginning, this is not a debate, even though it's sort of looking like a little bit like that. So I'm going to move on to the next question, and if you want to incorporate some of your response into the next question, you can. So Mr. O'Malley first, same question to both candidates. Given the stigma put on law enforcement profession by high-profile cases of police conduct, such as the murder of Mr. George Floyd, how can the prosecutor's office help encourage people to go into law enforcement?
That's a great question, because there is no doubt that the George Floyd murder has had a negative impact on not just law enforcement, people in black and whites and driving around our neighborhoods, because we all know the amount of police that all the agencies are down. When I was on Cleveland City Council 20 years ago, we had 2,000 officers. We're falling below 1,200 in Cleveland right now. It's across the board. But it doesn't just hit people in the black and whites. Within our own office, we are having a difficult time hiring people because of such the negative image on people who are trying to keep people safe and enforce laws. And it's sad. And so what do? I've contacted the dean at Cleveland State and say, can't we have some prosecutors teach some classes? Because God knows there's public defenders teaching classes. How about some prosecutors? How about people starting to do ride-alongs in cars where we can see? We have to try to get people into my office, because the other issue that we're having is 30 years ago when I graduated from Cleveland Marshall College of Law, we had a graduating class of 300. They're now down to 140, 130. The numbers have fallen drastically. So what I do every year is I bring in 40 law school interns from across the state where we try to get people interested in becoming a prosecutor. And if I didn't do that, for instance, we just had people take the bar and their passing came out 2 weeks ago. I had eight clerks seven of whom passed the bar, and I'm very proud of each and every one of them. But they were guaranteed employment as soon as they passed the bar. So, again, it's difficult. We got to get in the communities. We got to promote the good work that we do. But make no mistake, we do good work. Thank you.
All right. I do want to respond to some things from the last question. I'll make it quick. My opponent wants you to believe that the maximum possible sentence for somebody who is a discretionary bindover case, that they commit right before their 18th birthday is 3 years. That's not true. I mentioned earlier that there is a serious youthful offender sentence that is available for serious crimes in juvenile court. What this is that the court imposes both an adult and a juvenile sentence. And if the child serves the juvenile sentence without issue, then the adult sentence goes away. And if they don't, then the adult sentence is served. It is, in fact, a way to give a child an additional chance at rehabilitation without sacrificing public safety. And it is a tool that the prosecutor's office has not sufficiently used over the last several years. Now, on the point of sort of making sure that prosecutor's offices can encourage sort of both folks to serve as police and to support police, I've talked with a lot of police officers over the last year as I've been out at these community meetings. And I'm hearing all sorts of different issues that they're having during this nationwide recruitment crisis that we're seeing. But the number one morale issue that I've heard from across the different police districts in Cleveland and different suburbs, including some of the suburbs that are represented here today, is the fact that they are working up some of these serious juvenile cases that we've seen, and the prosecutor's office is not taking those cases. Now, unlike in adult court, there is no alternative sort of prosecutor's office that can take a case if the county prosecutor's office does not take it. This is something that I have heard repeatedly from police officers that I've talked to is an issue that is causing their officers to feel like their work is not meaningful, that they're losing ownership over what they're doing. And that's the kind of thing that if there's a case that needs to be, not taken, that I personally should be accountable to those police officers and explaining why we're not taking it. Thank you.
So I'm going to keep Robin on her toes. This question, last question before we open it up to the audience, is just a one-minute response. It's a shorter question. Please discuss your plans to ensure there is diversity within the prosecutor's office so it reflects the community they serve. Mr. On first.
And this is actually sort of responsive to the last discussion as well. A strong leader is somebody who understands how to attract talent, to retain talent, and to make sure that the folks that work for them, again, have ownership over their work and feel supported by the office. This is something that I've heard from my students, regardless of where they're working at, right? Certain spaces do not feel comfortable for them to work in. And we want to make sure that the folks in the office have that comfort in the office, regardless of what demographic they might be a part of. I teach a class on race and the law, and I've thought a lot about how to make sure that we're not just hiring folks of color, but that we're actually keeping them. And that's a really important, part of what the office needs, right? It needs to have folks who have sort of a variety of experiences so as to handle a variety of situations. I want to make sure that we hire folks of color, right, folks, LGBTQ folks, as well as in roles that where it makes sense, folks who may have been formerly incarcerated, because they are part of this conversation as well.
You know, since I became the county prosecutor, we've had a committee called the Minority Recruitment Committee where we actively go out to all the law schools in our surrounding areas. We sit down, especially at the student hiring days, and we actively try to recruit minority students into our employment. Now, like most jobs, Government jobs pay a little bit less than private sector jobs. So what we do is try to do our best to try to sell government service because of the good work we do on behalf of the people of our county. So we have an active committee that goes out, recruits people, and we do a good job at it.
Okay, this is your opportunity. And so I'm going to go and give you some instructions. There are two microphones, one on this side and one on that side. And the audience member should state your name and the community you're from, and then ask a brief question. This is not an opportunity for you to make a statement, just a very brief question. 15 seconds is what we're recommending. So ask your question in 15 seconds or less. And we ask that the audience members only ask one question. And so when you are called on, please state your name and the city you're from. And we'll allow up to 90 seconds for each candidate to respond. Direct your question to either Mr. Ahn or Mr. O'Malley or both, and both will have an opportunity regardless to respond to each question. Okay. And we have different clubs and different communities that are represented here. We'd like to hear from all of the communities here that are represented, but let's start with the first question. So 15 seconds.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name is Anise Mayo. I am a resident of Cleveland, locally on the west side. My question to you is related to the jail. The jail has been a thorn in everyone's side, especially everyone sitting here, because it is, you want to spend $1 billion. So my question is how do you plan to reduce the jail population?
Thank you. And I'll just start with Mr. O'Malley, and then we'll rotate back and forth. So the next one, you'll add.
Well, first on my part, we have to be prepared as an office every day to go to trial. And so the key, at least on my end, is trying to get the court processing our cases. As I've indicated, we've dropped the jail population in the 7 years that I've been there, 700. The difficulty and the thing that most people don't realize is that there is also misdemeanors being sentenced to the county jail. So what I would say to you is that what we need to do